Okay. Hi, everybody. I hope all are as well as can be. We are, like last week, going to dedicate the learning that we are doing for the full recovery of everybody who's wounded, for the return, the safe return of all of the hostages, and also for the safe return of all of our soldiers and their victory over the forces of evil. Okay, let's get started. So today we're going to do our second class on the land of Israel. And we are going to talk about water. No? Okay, water. Why is this not working? Here we go. Okay, we're going to talk about water. So water, of course, is extremely significant, particularly in the land of Israel. It's also very significant this time of year, right? Just a week and a half ago, we had our Tfilat Geshem. We changed from asking for dew to asking for rain, Mashiv HaRuach u'Morid HaGeshem. And we did our Hoshanot, right? Walking around. In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, walking around the altar, today walking around the Bima and Shul, but the idea of calling out Hoshanot with our Aravot, with our willows that need water. And water is, of course, very, very important, and scarce in the land of Israel. And it's something that definitely defines our relationship to the land and our relationship to God. And we'll see that in a minute. But I always, whenever I teach about water and about rain, I always remember a story, from when I was, visiting in Canada. I was visiting my in-laws and we were staying, by their cottage, which of course is in an area that's called, I don't know, something like a thousand islands or whatever. It's all water. It's all lakes. And a guy came to fix something in the house and he was talking to my husband and he said to him, "So where do you live?" "Oh, we live in Israel. What's it like there?" My husband's telling him a little bit about the country and we have the Kinneret. It's one lake. And the guy looks at him like, "You have one lake? How is that even possible that there's only one lake in the whole country?" So water is something that is scarce here. It's a very rare and precious commodity. And that, of course, magnifies its importance. So just for the sake of people who were not here last week, if you were here, I apologize. We'll just do this quickly. There's a very, very basic difference between the land of Israel, and the land that the Israelites come out of. Right. And that, of course, is the land of Egypt. And Moses, in his final speech in Sefer Devarim, in the book of Deuteronomy, when he's preparing the people for entering the land, one of the things he says to them is, Ke'aretz asher atah ba'shamah lirishta lo ke'aretz Mitzrayim. The land that you are about to enter is not like the land of Egypt. And that's why I brought this great satellite photo, because you could see this is a picture of Egypt at night. And Egypt is a very vast country, but everybody lives along the Nile. Okay. The Nile is life in Egypt. Everybody needs the Nile. Without the Nile, you can't survive. It is a constant, never, disappointing source of water. On the other hand, you can only live where the Nile reaches. And that's true. Certainly was true thousands of years ago, but it's even true today. On the other hand, the land of Israel is Eretz Harim Ubkaot. It's a land of hills and valleys. It's a land that doesn't have that constant source. Okay, we're going to address some of the water sources in the land of Israel in this Zoom, but we don't have a constant, never failing source like the Nile. Our water comes from rain, and rain is something that, when it comes, it's wonderful, but it doesn't always come. And that's why we pray for rain. And that's why rain is deeply entwined in Jewish thought, in the Torah and the rabbis with reward and punishment, right? God communicates with us through rain. And we see that even today in the land of Israel, by the way. Even today, okay, it's been a little overshadowed in the last week and a half. We've been dealing with other things. But usually the first big rain of the season, very big deal. Right. It's reported all over the news. The kids go outside with their umbrellas and their rubbers. We're excited. We're excited about rain. And when it doesn't rain, when it's a dry year, it's something that is reflected. People are disappointed. People are upset. It's on the news all the time. And when we do have a rainy year, that's something that we talk about all the time. And it's not like Israel doesn't have other sources of water, as we'll see towards the end, but we're still very tied to this idea of the importance of rain. Okay. And that, of course, comes from Vayayim Shamoah, right? From the second paragraph of the Shema, right? That when you behave, when you do the mitzvot, you will have rain. And then if you have rain, then you're going to have all of your crops are going to grow, your agriculture is going to work, right? But that only dependent on your behavior. And that, of course, is the continuation of that pasuk in Dvarim, Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Doresh Ota Tamid. God is always watching this land. There's a back and forth. There's a sachar va'onesh. And this idea of rain is a sign that God is on our side. We see it. The prophets talk about it. Famously, the prophet Amos talks about how God's going to make it rain in one place and not in another place, right? Which is something that he himself witnessed in the desert, that you could see rain in one place and sun in another place. But rain is this reflection of God's connection to us. And that's why we have this great Gemara in Ta'anit. Rabbi Yehuda said, a rainy day is as great as the day the Torah was given, right? This is the exact opposite of rain, rain, go away, right? Our approach is a rainy day is a gift from God, right? It literally is a gift from God. And rain and water in general, not just rain, but water in general, of course, is a metaphor for many different things that the rabbis talk about. It's a metaphor, of course, for life, but it's also, water is also a metaphor for Torah. It's a metaphor for kings and the long life of kings. The other great metaphor, of course, in the land of Israel, and we'll get to that in a few classes, is the opposite, right? Is the inverse, and that's the desert, right? The desert is also very important metaphor in Judaism, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. So let's talk a little about water sources. Okay, so in Israel we have this concept of a nahal or a wadi. Okay, when you go on a hike with your kids and you're very excited and you tell them we're going to nahal this and this, right? We're going to wadi this and this, and they're like, oh great, get the bathing suits, right? Not always, right? Israel has two kinds of nechalim, two kinds of nachals. One is a nachal etan, which always has water, and one is, and it's a much more common one, a nachal achzav, which sounds in modern Hebrew like it's a disappointing nachal, right? It means it's a nachal that doesn't always have water, right? And that word nachal or wadi in Arabic or riverbed or gorge, it doesn't mean a river. And this is the contrast in these pictures. You may be able to recognize on the left is the Great Mississippi River. Okay. We don't have one of those. Okay? The Jordan is hardly comparable. What we have are riverbeds, which there are some that do have water all year long, particularly if you go to the north, the places like the Dan or the Banyas, we're going to look at those, you have Ein Gedi or Wadi Kelt. Those do have water all the time, but you have a great number of riverbeds like this very dramatic scene here on the right, which is Nahal Tzin in the desert, which is a very dramatic, beautiful landscape that does fill with water, but only when we have a flash flood. So a riverbed does not necessarily guarantee water. It means it's a potential for water, right? So that's important to understand. How do we collect our water? Okay, so there are a number of ways. There's a number of ancient examples of water collection or water sources. Okay. So the most famous one is the most confusing one is in the picture on the left. And even if you don't read Hebrew, it should be easy to understand what we're looking at. We have two things which sound very similar in Hebrew, and that's why they're confusing. In English, they do not sound similar. We have a bor on the left here. Okay. And we have a be'er. A bor is a cistern. A be'er is a well. Those two things do not sound at all similar in English, but in Hebrew, they can be confusing. Okay. What is a bor? A bor is basically a hole in the ground. Okay. That usually has, some kind of channels leading water to it. We'll talk about that in a second. Okay. And in order for the water to be retained, it has to be plastered in some way, but it's not a water source. It's a receptacle for the water that is going to flow into it. And in order to live in this land, certainly in the desert, you need to have quite a lot of borot, of cisterns, right? And on the right here, you have one of the great cisterns at Herodion, right? The desert fortress that Herod builds because there's not enough rain. So when you have rain and in the desert, you can have these flash floods. You have to be smart enough to build channels to direct the water into your cisterns. You have to build big enough cisterns that you can not waste any of that water. You don't want any overflow. You want it all to flow into your cistern. Okay. But you want to have aqueducts. You want to have channels that are going to lead that water there. That's why we have this, well-known Gemara in Brachot, right? Which is talking about, King David and the people of Israel and how they can make a living. And he says to them, go and, do business with each other. And they respond to him and they say, a single handful of food does not satisfy a lion, and a pit will not be filled merely from the rain that falls directly into its mouth. Ein habor mitmalei michulyato. The chulya, the opening of the bor, is this. We can never rely on just that little bit of rain that falls directly over the chulya. That's nothing. We need to have channels coming from all directions to fill up the bor. Okay? So that's the rabbis understood that very clearly. Everybody in ancient times understood that very clearly. And you needed to keep those channels clean, right? Just like you clean out your roof gutters every fall. You got to clean out your channels for the cistern so that the water will flow in there. A be'er is something else entirely. A be'er is when you dig until you reach groundwater, mei tahom. Okay? And that's what you have down here. A be'er, a well, on the one hand is a lot of work, right? Sometimes you need to dig very deep in order to reach the water. And I have two examples here I'll show you in a minute. On the other hand, as opposed to a cistern, a be'er, a well can last for a long time, right? If you reach a good source of groundwater, you can have that water for a while instead of having only the seasonal rainwater, rainfall of the cistern, which is used up at the end of the winter. Okay. So, but you have to work hard. You have to make sure that nobody stops up your wells, right? And that's the example we have here from Sefer Bereishit, right? What's the main thing that Yitzchak, that Isaac is doing all the time? He's re-digging wells. Okay? Isaac dug and knew the wells which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, which the Philistines had stopped up after Abraham's death. The well doesn't usually dry up. It can happen if there's climate change, if there's some drastic catastrophe. But usually the well doesn't dry up. What happens is that people can stop up the well. So that's why he has to keep on redigging the well because the Philistines, in their destruction, stop up the well. So I brought you two pictures here. The well on the left, part of it is reconstructed. This trough is reconstructed. Obviously, this wood parts. But this is a well from Tel Sheva, which is an archaeological site right outside of Be'er Sheva, right to the east of Be'er Sheva. And it's a well that was dug not in the time of Abraham, but it does go back to the first temple period, and it's 70 meters deep, 210 feet deep. Can you imagine digging something that deep in the days before bulldozers or any kind of, electrical drill? It's an immense, immense amount of work, but then you have this steady water source. Okay. The well on the right is somewhat more modern. This is a well from the pioneers in Rishon LeZion. In the 1880s, the first Aliyah come to Rishon LeZion. They're farmers. They want to be able to settle, but there's no water. How are we going to survive without water? And they dig and they dig and they dig and they go meter after meter after meter. They're not finding anything until finally they reach water. And that's an enormous, joyful day in the community because now they can survive. So that's a be'er as opposed to a bor, a be'er reaching the groundwater. We also have another source of water besides the bor and the be'er, and that's the ma'ayan, the spring. Okay. A spring is living waters. It's ever flowing waters. We have many springs in Israel, some of them large, some of them small. What is special about the Mayan as opposed to the Bor or the Be'er? Okay. The Mayan flows. Right? The Mayan flows and it keeps on going and it doesn't stop. And it's new water all the time as opposed to sitting water, which is what both the Bor and the Be'er are. And that's why we have this beautiful lesson from Pirkei Avot. And we read these things, and this is what we were talking about a little bit last time, right? We read these statements by the rabbis or the prophets, and we say, oh, that's a nice image, but we don't really think about it. But these are the images that they saw in their daily life, right? So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had five students, and he enumerated their virtues. Here are two of them. Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus is a plastered cistern which loses not a drop. Bor seed she'eno me'abed tipa. Okay, plastered cistern. This is a good example here on the right. This is in a monastery, a Byzantine monastery in the Judean desert called the Avtimus Monastery. It's an amazing, huge cistern that is designed to catch every one of those drops of flash floods. You can see the plaster, right? You can see the plaster. Here's all this nice plaster that has still stayed around. And that plaster holds in the water. Right? The plaster holds in the water. And that is a very significant and important thing. However, this toolbar is doing things that I do not want it to do. Okay. Good. Sorry, Zoom, trying to be too smart. Don't be so smart, Zoom. Okay, so board CJ, no, ma'abed tipa. It's a plastered cistern which doesn't lose a drop. The water stays inside. It's retained. It doesn't leak out. Whereas Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is like a spring that ever gathers force, a mayan hamitgaber. What is the difference between these two things? How can we compare these two scholars? A board CJ, no, ma'abed tipa. Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, otherwise known as Rabbi Elazar, the great Hagadol, he is famous. We have this, his statements all over Gemara about how he never says anything that he didn't learn from his teachers before him. Okay. He is an enormous vault, a bank of information, but he's not an innovator. Okay. He passes on what he has learned. And that's hugely important because we need the people who are going to retain the traditions and pass them on and teach us what our earlier teachers said. But he's not an innovator. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is a very different personality. He's a spring. He's a Mayan HaMitgaber. He's always coming up with new ideas. It's never the same idea twice. He's always innovating. Is one better than the other? No. But they are very different. And these are beautiful images that express that difference. Okay. And I think that's also something that's important to understand about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, that he's a master teacher, right? A teacher who can appreciate what is unique and special about each one of his students and how one is not necessarily better than the other, but each one has his own special qualities that contribute to the world. So that is, it's one of my favorite, statements in Pirkei Avot. Okay. Now, let's say I have water in one place and I need to get it somewhere else, right? It's very nice if I have a spring in my backyard, if I have a well in my backyard, but that doesn't always happen. So what do we have in Second Temple times? We have this brilliant innovation that begins, Herod uses it, but it begins with the Romans. He learns it from the Romans. The Hasmoneans use it, also learning Roman technology, and that's called an aqueduct. Right? An aqueduct is a way to move water from one place to another. Now you need to have you need to have topography to help you, right? The water has to be a little bit higher. It always has to be going downhill. You need to have good engineers who can figure it out. But if you can do that, and we have aqueducts in various places, Roman ones that have still survived in the land of Israel and certainly all over the Roman Empire. And if you can do that, you can bring water from a place that has no water to a place, from a place that has water to a place that has no water, right? And that's a very significant thing. It enables agriculture. It enables civilization. It's very significant. But the Romans did something else that is, they didn't have just plain aqueducts, right? Just one kind of moving the water from one place to another, but they had things that were even more sophisticated. And this is a great one. We have such a thing in the land of Israel. It's in, today in Parc Canada. This is not a picture from there. This is a picture from, I think it's, Provence. Okay. But we do have such a thing here in Israel. And this is called a castellum divisorium. Okay. And the idea is like this. The water comes in at one end, okay, and then it goes out in different directions. It's not, you can send one out to one side, one field, and one out to a pool, and it goes out and what goes in one way, it comes out in another way. It's this nice hub, I guess is the word we're looking for, right? And the rabbis, of course, are familiar with this also, and like everything else in their world, they use it as a metaphor to teach something. So Rabbi Levi said, this is a Midrash in Vayikra Rabbah, this is like a truskal, okay? A lot of times in our Midrashim, because people copied and they didn't know the words, they didn't know the Latin or the Greek, the words kind of got messed up, but today we're able to really figure it out. And when it says a truskal, we understand it's a castel, or what I told you, showed you here, a castellum divisorium, okay? Whose owner hired workers to fill it. Okay, now what's the image here? The foolish one says, what good am I doing? I fill on one end and it goes out the other. The wise one says, aren't I getting paid for each bucket I put in? Now, whenever I teach this medrash, I always say it's very consoling because that's the mashal, right? That's the parable. What's the nimshal? What is it teaching you? Hey, okay, the nimshal says, I learn and I learn and I just forget and forget. It goes in one ear and it goes out the other. And what good am I doing? I fill it on one end and it goes out on the other. And the wise man says, okay, but I'm getting sachar. I'm getting reward for every bucket that I'm putting in. So maybe I'm not remembering everything at the end of the day, but God sees my efforts and I get reward. So we can, those of us who are somewhat forgetful can feel good from this nice mashal. Okay. Besides rain, okay, we also have something that's very important, towards the end of the summer, in the springtime, and that's dew. Okay. Tal. We, in the summer months, we say v'tein tal livracha. And in the winter, we say tal umatar. We want dew and rain. But in the summer, we don't want and we don't expect to have rain. So we only want dew because dew is also important. Even when you don't want rain, you still want some wet in your garden, right? You want to wake up in the morning and your flowers have some moisture there. And we think of dew as something very good, right? Tal is gentle. It's benevolent, right? We have this beautiful, beautiful verse in the book of Hosea and Shabbos Shuvah. Eyeh katal Yisrael, right? God says, I will be to Israel like dew. Yifrach kashoshana. God will blossom like the lily. V'yach shorashav kalibanon. He shall strike root like a tree in Lebanon. So here we have tal, that the cobweb is shaped like the land of Israel. Yeah, I guess so. I think we're seeing Israel everywhere. My sister showed me a pic, took, sent me a picture of how her schnitzel looked like the land of Israel. So I think we are programmed to see that right now. But here, tal, of course, is a good thing, right? Tal is a gift. It is a blessing. But we also have another pasuk, also in Hosea, right? Which is not a positive imagery of tal. Ma eselcha Ephraim, ma eselcha Yuda, v'chasdechem ka'anan boker, uketal mashkim holech. What can I do for you, Ephraim? What can I do for you, Judah, when your goodness is like morning clouds, like dew so early gone? Sometimes you have dew that it just dissipates very, very, very quickly. It doesn't actually give any real moisture to the plants. It doesn't give any blessing. And that's how the Navi is comparing the children of Israel. Ephraim and Judah, oh, you think you're so good. You go and you do all your good deeds. No, it's all gone in a second, right? Your tal is actually harming and not helping at all. So tal has these two directions that it can go in. It can be a blessing, but it could also be a curse. Okay.
How to leave
So
it.
from this kind of general look at water, we're going to move into more particulars, okay? And the bodies of water in the land of Israel, okay? We're not going to look at the Mediterranean, at least not this time, but we are going to look at the other bodies of water that we have here. And the most important one to start with, of course, is the Jordan. Okay. The title is actually a song by Naomi Shemer. Lashir ze kmo Yarden, to sing is to be like the Jordan, right? That you start out in your life very full and flowing and rich, and you ultimately end up in the Dead Sea. It's actually a beautiful song if you look it up on YouTube after the class. But the Jordan is Israel's only real river. Okay. It begins up here. We're going to see the source waters in a minute. Three source waters all the way far in the north, flows down into the Sea of Galilee, into the Kinneret, flows out, flows down, and ends up, its terminus is in the Dead Sea. Okay. Along the way, it's fed by other springs, by other rivers like the Yarmouk, like the Yabok, right? Like the Zarka in Jordan. Its name, Yarden, we think comes from Yored, as in it flows all the way down to that lowest point of the Dead Sea. Jordan, as we're going to see in a couple minutes, is very important in biblical times. If you look over here on the map on the right side, you can see how it's a border, but it isn't a border, right? Because on the west side of the Jordan are most of the tribes, right? Are 10 and a half tribes. But on the right side of the Jordan, you also have Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe. You also have non-Jewish nations, Ammon, Edom, right? Moab, not Edom, Ammon and Moab. So the Jordan is a quasi-border, let's say. Okay. It runs almost the length of the state of Israel, not quite. It's 251 kilometers. Okay. The Jordan source waters, there are three source waters. Just look back for a second, right? Those source waters are up here. Okay, these three up here, as well as snow melt. Well, we don't have the Don in this picture, but they're all up here. Okay, as well as snow melt from the Hermon. Okay, so the source waters are the Banias, right? And anybody who's been to Israel, certainly if you've been in the summer, you've come up to the north and you've seen the beautiful national parks. It's one of the few places in Israel where you really can see enormous amounts of flowing water. Right, that's not such a thing we see so much in Israel, but certainly in the winter, but even in the summer, these are nechalim that are etanim. They are very strong. They are flowing all the time. Okay, so you have the Banias, you have the Dan, and you have the Sneer or the Chutzpani. Okay, the Sneer is the Hebrew name. We have it in Tanakh. The Chutzpani is the Arabic name. Because these waters are so strong and so powerful, there's always been civilizations near these waters. The Dan, of course, is the story of the tribe of Dan that moves from the center of the country. They don't like being squeezed by the Philistines. They move up north. They take land up there. And of course, we have by the national park of the Dan, where the source waters of the Dan are, we have Tel Dan. We have the ancient site of the tribe of Dan. Okay, so that's our source waters of the Jordan. as the Jordan flows down, okay, there's actually a dam at the bottom part of the Kinneret. Okay, it's called Secher Dagania. It was originally built to create a power plant. Today, we want to keep the water in the Kinneret as kind of like a reservoir for emergency purposes. So very, very rarely is the Dagania Dam opened. It's usually closed. We don't allow too much water to flow into the Jordan, which is actually problematic because the southern portion of the Jordan is becoming more and more polluted and smaller. It keeps shrinking over and over again. So now, since 2013, we do have a small constant flow from the Kinneret south into the Jordan to rehabilitate the polluted Jordan. But in general, the Dagania Dam is left mostly closed because we want to keep that water in the Kinneret. We don't want it to flow out. Just once we're speaking of dams for a moment, the first electrical power plant in Israel is made by somebody named Pinchas Rutenberg in the 1930s. Very, very interesting character. Comes from Russia. He's involved in the Russian Revolution. He's very fascinating. And he decides to harness the power of two rivers, right? He goes to a place called Naharaim. Naharaim meaning two nahars, two rivers, the Jordan and the Yarmouk, right? And he uses the water to create the first electrical power plant in Israel in the 1930s. So that's just interesting in and of itself. There's more to talk about that story, but we won't do it right now. Okay, let's go back to the Jordan for a moment. Okay, the Jordan is very important in Tanakh. Okay, as we saw before, it's this quasi-border. It's also the area where we enter the land. Okay, when we come into the land after the exodus from Egypt, after the wandering in the desert, we come into the land when we cross the Jordan opposite Jericho, right? And how do we cross? We cross because there's a miracle. The water is stopped, right? The priests come, walk into the Jordan. They are holding the Ark of the Covenant. The water stops. It piles up, right? Here we have the Pasuk in Yoshua, right? When the priests' feet come to rest in the water, the waters of the Jordan, the water coming from upstream, will be cut off and will stand in a single heap. Okay. Now we are pretty sure where this event happened. It's a place called Qasr al-Yahud, which is at the almost the southernmost point of the Jordan, just before it flows into the Dead Sea. This is a place that's very important for Christians who believe that Jesus is baptized here by John the Baptist. But it's also very important for Jews because this is a place that it's clear that it's opposite Jericho. And the book of Joshua says that the children of Israel cross the Jordan opposite Jericho. So this place, Qasr al-Yahud, which means the crossing point of the Jews, right? The Arabs retained the identity of the place in the name. And this was a very important place for Christians for centuries. They've built churches and monasteries here. In after 1967, before 1967, this was under the control of Jordan. After 1967, it becomes under the control of Israel. Unfortunately, terrorists used it as a way to cross into Israel, and so the army closed it off. They mined it. They got rid of all the priests and the monks who were living there. They evacuated them. In the late 80s, the Vatican started to put pressure on Israel to open the site up again. And first it was opened only under kind of direct army. You had to be escorted by the army. Today it's a national park and you can go there. And it's actually an amazing thing because you can really see where the people crossed the Jordan. Right? Where is this place, right? It's right opposite here, opposite Jericho. We have this rather strange verse in the book of Joshua, right? Which says the water's coming from upstream, piled up in a single heap, a great way off at Adam, the town next to Zartan. Harchek ma'od me Adam ha'ir. Okay? Why do we care about the town of Adam? Why is this important? So classical commentators like the Radak say, oh, well, Adam was was a city that was right near where they crossed. And because the waters stopped and they piled up and they piled up, you would think that Adam would have been drowned. It would have been covered in the water, this overflow of the Jordan water, but it was a miracle and they weren't. But today we actually understand that Adam is not near here, but Adam is about 30 kilometers north. Okay. Today we have a crossing, Gesher Adam, so a place that you could cross into Jordan. And this is far north. So what does it have to do with the story? So we have a very nice explanation by a scholar named Ze'ev Erlich, who says every once in a while, there's a storm, usually a little bit of an earthquake, and stones fall from the hills and block up the Jordan. Now, this happens not over here near Jericho, where if you've ever been here, you know that there's plains. It's nice and flat over here. But if you go further north, the mountains, as you can see in the picture here, come right up close to the Jordan. And if you have an earthquake, boulders are going to be knocked loose and will actually stop up the Jordan River for a half a day, for a day, sometimes even for 2 days. We have evidence that this happened in 1927, the last time we had a big earthquake in Israel. The Jordan River was stopped up for a couple of days. Ze'ev Erlich says maybe this is what's happening with our story, right? Now you'll say, oh, but that's, we don't want to think of it that way because this is a miracle. God does a miracle. He makes the water stop. No, it is a miracle because it happens at exactly the right time, right? A miracle can be nature if it's timed exactly right. And it's actually a beautiful explanation because here we are coming into the land. We need to start living our lives more naturally. And so our miracles are also somewhat more natural. Okay, if you go along the Jordan and you don't go so far down, but you go much closer to the Kinneret, right, where the Kinneret empties out again into the Jordan, you'll find a site that's called Yardenit, which, unlike Kasar al Yehud, which you may have been able to tell, is not exactly super clean. Okay, it's actually rather polluted, not just muddy. Yardenit is actually pristine and beautiful and a lovely place to go swimming. It does not seem to be the place where the story of Jesus and John the Baptist happened, but people were not so picky. And actually, Israel very, very cleverly, in the years when Kasar al Yehud was under Jordanian control, Israel wanted Christian pilgrims to be able to come and go to this important site where Jesus was baptized. And they said, well, okay, we can't go there, so we'll create an alternate site. And that's what they did. And even today, you have many, many groups that will come to Yardenit, either because they happen to be staying in the north and it's more convenient, or just because it's a really a much nicer site. So that's Yardenit. Okay, we're going to move on a little to the Kinneret. Okay, the Kinneret is our one lake. Yes, we call it the Sea of Galilee, but let's be realistic. It's not a sea, it's a lake. Okay. It is 21 kilometers from north to south. At its widest point, it's 13 kilometers wide. This is rather small. Why is it called the Kinneret? Some people suggest we already have the name in Tanakh. Some people suggest that it looks like a kinnor, that it looks like a harp, and that's where the name comes from. We're actually not 100% sure that that's where the name comes from, but it's a good suggestion. It is the main reservoir, as we mentioned, the largest reservoir in Israel. We do have other reservoirs, but this is the largest one. Because it's a constant source of fresh water, so it has sites around it already from prehistoric times, very important in Christianity. You have a lot of stories that take place in the New Testament that take place around the Kinneret. Also very important for early Jewish settlers of the Second Aliyah who come and create places like Degania. Right, or Kfutzat Kinneret. These are very important sites. We are always very concerned about the water in the Kinneret, how much water there is. We don't want the water level to get too low or the groundwater will be contaminated. So we're always kind of on this watch, watching the Kinneret. This was put up, I don't know, a long time ago, at least 10 years ago, to be like this Kinneret meter. to understand how much water is in the Kinneret at any given point, and we watch the Kinneret's progress like a parent watches a child's report card, right? We'll always say, ah, is it up? Is it down? How's it doing? Right? We drive up there in the springtime, and we say, oh, look, the beach that was, exposed last winter is now covered up, right? We're always watching. This water, though, does not only stay in the Kinneret. Like we said, it's a water reservoir, but it's also a conduit. We have this amazing project that was created in the early years of the state in the 50s and the 60s, spearheaded by someone who eventually became Prime Minister, Levi Eshkol. But before he was Prime Minister, he did many other things. And one of them was to be the head of the whole water project of Mikorot and creating this, what we call the Movil Ha'artzi in Hebrew, or in English, the National Water Carrier. And you can see that it goes from the Kinneret. There's a pumping station, the northwestern part of the Kinneret called Sapir. Pumps the water to a huge reservoir called the Eshkol Reservoir, right over here, and then pumps it in two lines to the center and to the south and to the Negev. Okay, so very, very important project. The idea to do such a thing was already the idea already existed in the 1940s, but it was only put into action in those first decades of the state. Okay, moving from the Kinneret to our other sea again in quotation marks, and that's Yam HaMelach, right, or Yam HaMavet, the Dead Sea or the Salt Sea. Both of the names are important names that we use all the time. Tanakh also has another name, the Yam HaKadmoni, okay, the Eastern Sea. Now we're going to see some prophecies about the Eastern Sea. The Dead Sea, of course, is famous for its very large deposits of salt and of minerals. Almost nothing, like a few microorganisms, but almost nothing can live in the Dead Sea. In terms of its dimensions, it's 50 kilometers long and 15 wide, so 50 long and 15 wide. And of course, because of the salt, it has these amazing floating properties. It also stings a lot. Okay. Lowest place on Earth, one of the few things that Israel has that's Guinness Book of World Records. We don't have too many of those. The Dead Sea is the lowest place on Earth. How is it formed? Okay. Originally, it's millions of years ago. It's connected to the Mediterranean, right? There's one great sea. Then there's an earthquake creates the Jordan Rift, the Rift Valley, right? Creates the Jordan Valley, which is part of the Great Rift Valley. It's cut off from the Mediterranean, and a lake forms. And the water flows into it, evaporates, minerals are deposited. Flows in, evaporates, minerals are deposited. So the minuscule amount of salt and minerals that are in the Jordan, right, because they're coming from natural springs, okay, accumulate and accumulate and accumulate over millennia so that you have this incredible repository of salt and minerals that makes the Dead Sea really something unique in the world. Today, it is rare that you have any kind of boats on the Dead Sea. Today, you have mainly for environmental purposes, people take out boats to show how the sea is shrinking. It's a tourist kind of thing. But in ancient times, boats actually sailed on the Dead Sea. It was a way to get either from the northern end down to the south because there were cliffs and it was very hard to pass by land, or to get across from one side to the other. And we have this amazing picture. This is part of what's called the Medva map. Right, this is a huge mosaic map of our whole area, not our area, the land of Israel, that was discovered in a church in Jordan in the 19th century. It was made in Byzantine times, 1500 years ago, and it's amazing because it has all of these details with names in Greek of all these various places, and we can clearly see, right, first of all, the Jordan, which is full of fish. See all the fish swimming in the Jordan? And then opens up into the Dead Sea, which has no fish, But it does have boats, right? We do have boats on the Dead Sea. So that gives us an idea of what it might have been like in ancient times. The future of the Dead Sea, right? Fascinating that we have a few prophets that talk about water that's going to flow out from Jerusalem and out to the Dead Sea, and it's going to heal the Dead Sea. And one of the strongest images is in the book of Ezekiel, right? The end of the book of Ezekiel, Yechezkel, is this vision of the end of days, of messianic times. The prophet goes to the temple and he sees things in the temple. And here he sees water issuing from below the platform and going east, right? Where's the water going? So he's being led by a guide who's an angel. And he says, this water runs out to the east and flows into the Arava. And when it goes into the sea of foul waters, right, our sea, the water will become wholesome. Okay? And there will be fish, and the fishermen are going to come, and it's going to come back to life, right? It's this amazing image of the end of days that Jerusalem is going to heal the Dead Sea, or really is going to heal Stone, right? Jerusalem and Stone sort of are diametrically opposed to each other. So you have this beautiful vision. A few years ago, it was right before Corona, so I guess it was 2019, or maybe it was the beginning of the winter of 2020. There was actually a lot of rain in Israel, and you had something very unusual. You had lots of flowers blossoming right near the Dead Sea, and people were amazed by it. Everybody, all these photographers went to take pictures of it, and it really did fit in a way with this vision of the sea coming back to life. One of the famous and important qualities of the Dead Sea and the area of the Dead Sea is, of course, that we're in the desert, right? And it's very, very, very dry. There's almost no humidity down there. It's very hot, but it's very dry. And because of that, all kinds of incredible things have been preserved down there. Organic material, which normally is not preserved for a very long time. But of course, down near the Dead Sea, we have the most famous example is the pictures that you have here, the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? Parchment, organic material, which by all accounts really is not supposed to last so long. And yet it lasted more than 2,000 years down near the Dead Sea. But besides that really big thing, we've also found smaller things, pieces of fabric, other kinds of organic material, and even what we mentioned last week, the date pits, right, that were discovered in Masada and in Qumran, and that were actually able to be brought back to life. So this low humidity is actually an amazing gift, not just because it feels nice, but for archaeologists. The main issue that's going on with the Dead Sea today that we are becoming more and more and more aware of is the shrinking of the Dead Sea, right? And you can see that very dramatically and terribly in the pictures on the right. Okay. The size of the sea in 1972, right? Take a look at these satellite pictures. 1972, 1989, and 2011, right? And I don't even have a more contemporary picture. The sea is shrinking at the rate of 1 meter, 3 feet per year. Okay, that's an almost inconceivable number. It's a terrible number. Why is this happening? And more importantly, which I have a less of an answer for, what do we do about it? Okay, so it's happening. That's easy to answer. It's happening because we are stealing from the Dead Sea in both directions. As we mentioned before, we don't allow very much of the Jordan to flow into the Dead Sea. We want to hold on to that water in the Kinneret or use it for the national water carrier. So unlike in ancient times where the water freely flowed into the Dead Sea from the north, today we steal that water. It doesn't flow in so freely. The other thing that we do, which is more active even, that's you could say a little bit passive, this is very active, is at the southern end, and that's what you're seeing in the picture here, and also very dramatically in these pictures, we're actually drying up the southern end of the Dead Sea. And if you drive all the way down to the south, you'll see that there's actually a land bridge and the northern part of the Dead Sea is disconnected from the southern. There are like these little canals that connect it, but that's it because we have something called the Dead Sea Works. Now, the Dead Sea Works was a brilliant idea that was started in the 1930s, okay, by an Israeli engineer, a pre-state Israeli engineer named Moshe Novomisky, who said, the minerals that are in the sea are actually really valuable. Right? Now, we think about the mud and we use it for cosmetics, but that's like a drop in the bucket. There's potassium, right? There's all this stuff that's actually very useful. And he said, let's mine that. Let's take out those minerals and we can create an industry. Now, the original Dead Sea Works was in the north, but in 1948, that area was conquered and destroyed by the Jordanians. But soon afterwards, in the late 50s and the 60s, a new Dead Sea Works was created at the southern edge. On the one hand, it brought a lot of money into the Israeli economy. That's very important. On the other hand, it is ravaging the sea. And not only is it disastrous because we are losing an amazing natural phenomenon that has no like in the world, but it's actually also causing other kinds of damage, right? Remember those commercials where you say don't mess with Mother Nature, right? When you mess with Mother Nature can mess back. And about 15 years ago, a crazy phenomenon began near the Dead Sea, and that's where these sinkholes, bolanim in Hebrew, started opening up. The ground literally started to open up. Okay? This picture on the right here is a picture of the Ein Gedi Spa, which was destroyed because of sinkholes, because the ground actually opened up. What happens, right? Today we have more than 7,000 sinkholes in this area. What happens is that as the Dead Sea recedes, the groundwater right underneath the earth is also receding, and leaving a vacuum. Sweet water from the various springs nearby flows in and dissolves whatever earth there is. So you have this vacuum and then holes open up. So what are we going to do about this? How are we going to solve this problem? It is a problem. There's one silver lining to this problem, which is that it's an environmental problem, which is shared by Israel and Jordan and the Palestinians. And environmental problems tend to be things that bring people together more than politics. And so everybody's sort of trying to figure out this solution. This is a problem that's been discussed for a long time. Theodor Herzl, and this is the quotation you have here on the left, Theodor Herzl in his book Altneuland, talks about a canal from the Mediterranean to the Dead Sea to bring water, right? That's going to create power. We also talk about a canal from the Red Sea to the Dead Sea, right? All of these canals, which are, on the one hand, good, right? We would put more water into the sea. On the other hand, how is that going to change the ecosystem if we bring seawater into an area that had mostly somewhat salty fresh water? Everything's going to change. So meanwhile, not too much has been done, but there is growing awareness of this problem. There are people who are taking people out in boats on the Dead Sea to see what's happening. There's an artist in Israel, Sigalit Landau, who just had a very well-received exhibit in the Israel Museum, where she had all kinds of things that she kind of soaked in the Dead Sea, and they were covered in salt. And this was to raise environment and raise awareness of this issue. So it is something that people know about. Okay, before we get to our last things about the water, I want to bring in a little bit topical because we are, of course, talking about the area that in Hebrew is known as Otef Aza, the Gaza envelope, right? The communities that have been so affected in the last week and a half. And you can see here Be'eri and Nir Am, right? And so many others that are in this area. This is where the beginning of the war started. This is where the massacre happened in this area. This is where many of our soldiers are today in Se'elim and other areas around here. And so I wanted to kind of bring that into our story today. How is there even settlement in this area, right? This is an area that doesn't have water. We don't have the Jordan. We don't have the Kinneret. We have very little in the way of natural springs. In 1937, right, Britain comes out with something called the Peel Commission report where they divide up the land between Jews and Arabs. It doesn't happen. It's a proposal. But in this proposal, they gave the Negev to the Arabs. The Jews woke up and they said, wait a second, this proposal might not have passed, but something is going to pass one day. And we need to increase facts on the ground, Jewish settlement in the Negev, because if we don't have communities there, this is going to be given away. This is going to be given to the Arabs, and we need to push to have more settlement in the Negev. Very nice, but how do we do that without water? Right? And we're talking about the 1940s. Communities that we're talking about are agricultural communities. Even if they're not agricultural communities, how do you survive without water? And there's very little water in the Negev, and they don't know what to do. And they go to this guy here on the left, Simcha Blast, who's an engineer. His original thought is to do something that only actually happens, as we said, in the 50s, a national water carrier bringing water from the north. Israel does not have the resources to do that in the 1940s. So instead, what do? They actually find a nice amount of water springs near Am. Okay. That's what we have over here. One second. I just want to make sure that I'm saying this correctly and I'm not messing us up. Okay. So there's a lot of water. Yes, near Am. This is near Am up here. He discovers that there are springs here, and what they do is they lay pipes. They lay 220 kilometers of pipes. Where do the pipes come from? They actually come from London, where they were used as ways to put out fires during the Blitz, and somehow they make their way to Israel in the late 40s, mid 40s, and they lay 220 kilometers of pipes. One line going down here to the communities out in the south and the west, the other line going more towards the east. And because of these water pipes, we are able to create what are called the 11 points of settlement in the Negev, 11 communities that are created overnight. Okay? And in honor of this amazing feat, we have a poem that was written by the national poet of the time, Natan Alterman. He called it a concerto for a pipe, concerto latsinor. And I'll read it in Hebrew and translate. Lo pam nechleku de'ot chacham va'peti, et ha'historia mi'oseh le'mi ha'yitaron. Okay? Often, the fool and the wise man argue, who makes history? Who has the advantage? Echad machriz, osimotak ha'kabinetim, sheni shar ha'pkidot, shlishi to'en ha'hon. So one says it's the cabinet, another says it's the administrators, a third one says no, it's the money people, another one says it's the president, another one says it's the senator. Hasenator nachon achitachen ki ad lesof davar yuvrar od sheotah asa ha'instillator. Asher kivein sinor im beres lamidbar. They may all be right, but really it's the plumber who brought the pipes with the water to the desert. And when those pipes were brought, we were able to have water and we were able to survive in the Negev. And this is the 11 points of settlement in the Negev. Some of them are still around, like Nirim, like Be'eri, Shoval, Mishmar HaNegev. And these are really the places that were, unfortunately, a lot in the news and are still in the news today. That's a conversation for another time. But these are communities, right? This is what we call a community. Basically a few huts that some young people created so that there would be settlement in the Negev. Okay, the last little bit we'll do is we'll talk just a minute about wastewater treatment and desalinization. As much as we said, rain is important. Rain is part of our contract with God, yet we understand that we need to have other sources of water. And so Israel does two very significant things. One is that we treat wastewater. Our wastewater treatment is the highest percentage in the world. We treat 80% of our wastewater. That is tens of percents higher than the next country, which I think is Spain. Most of that wastewater is, I mean, none of it is used for drinking, but it's used for agriculture, which is what the most water goes to. Hey, the other thing we do is we desalinate, and we have five plants that desalinate seawater. So we are always looking for ways to increase our water sources, our water needs are always growing, so we always need to have more water. And we'll finish with this beautiful image of water because water is also not just about agriculture and everything else, but it's about a relationship with God and it's about purity. And Rabbi Akiva, at the end of the Mishnah in Yoma, the Mishnah that deals with Yom Kippur, Rabbi Akiva says, "How fortunate are you, Israel? Before whom are you purified, and who purifies you? It is your Father in heaven. As it is stated, I will sprinkle purifying water on you, and you shall be purified." And it says, "The ritual bath of Israel is God. Mikveh Yisrael Adonai." Mikveh could be a mikveh, like we know, a ritual bath. Mikveh comes from the same root as tikvah, right? Hope. God's Israel's hope is God. Okay? Rabbi Akiva is playing with that. Just as a ritual bath purifies the impure, so too the Holy One, blessed be He, purifies Israel. Okay, so we will finish that. Let's take a look at questions, comments. All right, hold on. Let's go back to the beginning. God and Reuven, we had an answer. Ice that stopped up Niagara Falls. Cool. What sources feed the Kinneret? The same sources that are the Jordan, meaning the Jordan feeds the Kinneret, and the three sources of the Jordan are the Don, the Banyas, and the Sneer. Okay. The Kinneret also has a few springs that go in, rainwater that comes from the Golan, but mostly from the Jordan. Kinnor is, today we say a kinnor is a violin. But in biblical times, a kinnor is a harp or, I mean, there are different names, a nevel, kinnor, but yes, more harp-like. Various streams, right? Okay. 416 Toronto area code. Don't know what that means. Okay. Is the water flowing from under the temple from May to home? Yeah, right. So Mona asks an interesting question. When the Nevi'im talk about this water, what are they talking about, right? We don't have water. Jerusalem has one spring. It has the Gihon spring. So this idea that there could be water flowing out of Jerusalem in Yechezkel, it's coming from under the Mikdash. In Zechariah, it's coming from Har HaZeitim, right? Har HaZeitim is going to split in two and there'll be water. That's kind of a miraculous idea. It's not that there is a water source necessarily, but this is the miracle of the end of days. Hey, how wide was the Jordan when Yoshua crossed? Not very wide. Right. And that's a good question. It's a question people ask every time I take them there. It was wider than it is today, for sure. However, main idea, I think, is that it's a miracle to show that God is with Joshua like he was with Moses, right? And it's not necessarily that they couldn't have waded across, but we want to have this dramatic moment of entering the land. Why isn't more water released to the Dead Sea in winters with a lot of rain? Yeah, so when we have a lot of rain, everybody's like watching the news and they say, "Oh, is Sechor Deganya going to be opened? Is it going to be opened? Is it going to be opened?" There are lines. There's a protocol, right? There's the lower red line, the top red line, and it's only when there's really a ton of rain. They might change that, but at the moment, that's the way they do it. Pipes to transport and not fire rockets. Yes. Chatzirim is still around. Yes, Chatzirim is an Air Force base. That's all. Thank you, everyone. Okay, I don't have any announcements because I'm not Rabbi Kelman, so everyone should have a good and a safe week. Certainly all of my friends here in Israel who joined, but everyone all over the world. Please continue to daven for us, to give money for us, to advocate for us as much as possible. As you see, it's very, very necessary. Thank you, everyone.
Stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for a wonderful show.
Thank you.
Sarah
Amen. Amen.
Amen.